I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Hello, In the City listeners. We're dropping this episode and future episodes of In the City earlier in the week. That's because we have a special treat for you releasing this Friday. As many of you know, this famously is a year of elections. Around 40% of the world's population have voted or will have the chance to vote in 2024. And those votes will shape the geoeconomic landscape for years to come. The implications are huge and worth exploring, which is why we're launching a bonus series called Votonomics. Bloomberg's head of government and economics, Stephanie Flanders, opinion columnist Adrian Woolridge, and In the City's very own Allegra Stratton will lead the charge. Every Friday, they'll take a few steps back from the weekly news agenda and help you understand how the latest political movements are influencing markets, business, and policy. This year, voters around the world have the ability to affect markets, countries, and economics like never before. Let Votonomics help you make sense of it all. So on Tuesdays, you'll still get a weekly taste of what's driving the conversations happening in the city and on Wall Street. And now, on Fridays, a more focused look at where politics and markets collide. Stay tuned, and we hope you enjoy.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
Are we excited?
Excited.
We're so excited.
I'm dizzy from my donut.
We have a lot of donut left.
Sugar.
Yeah, there'll be a low at some point as well, Dave.
I'm going to crash in a minute.
In mid-podcast. I forgot my question.
I feel like I need to give you a tequila shot. Like, I don't know, counter or something.
Welcome to the City of London.
The City of the City.
The City of London.
The next station is Bank. Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
The financial heart of the country.
The city.
The city.
Welcome to In the City.
Stand clear of the doors, please.
Time for a weekly look at the conversations motivating power brokers, policymakers, and financiers the world over. This week, all eyes on the US and UK economies, and the race to cut interest rates first. I'm Francine Lacqua.
I'm David Merritt.
And I'm Allegra Stratton.
Hi, everyone.
I'm not going to print out. I didn't realize. That's why I'm so sorry. That's why I was like, oh my God, there's a piece of paper. Hold on, wait.
Hey, that was perfect.
I was wondering, am I supposed to say who I am?
No. So this week, we're lucky enough to have Phil Aldrich, who's just come back from the IMF World Bank meetings, to give us a glimpse of the conversations in the corridors of power and actually what central banks will do next.
Welcome back to In the City, Phil.
Hi, Dave.
Hi. Tell us about your trip. What was it? What was the word on the ground in DC as everyone debated the state of the world economy?
It was slightly odd because obviously whilst meetings were happening, we were having the Israel-Iran strikes, and obviously Ukraine and Russia still going on. So there was these two, the backdrop was these two wars and political uncertainty that is becoming just the norm at the moment. Then it was kind of all seen through the very IMF prism of what it means for the global economy and what it means for interest rates. You have at the moment this prospect of the Federal Reserve in the US possibly even pushing interest rates higher because inflation is proving quite sticky. And the IMF was saying that the US economy is overheating effectively. And that has repercussions for the developing world where, you know, they have a lot of debt priced in dollars and it becomes more and more unaffordable as the dollar increases. And then back here in the UK and in Europe, we're seeing a sort of central bank divergence as the Eurozone European Central Bank and the Bank of England look like they may be going in opposite direction or moving significantly earlier than the Fed.
Just to back up a little bit on the US economy, though, people haven't been tracking it that closely. How do we get it all so wrong? I mean, there were predictions for a recession in the US this year. We had the fastest hiking cycle in recent memory. And yet the IMF, what you're just saying now is the IMF is saying the US economy is overheating. How is that possible with interest rates where they are? And how did the whole world and all the economists and all the market traders, everyone, get it all so wrong?
Well, as someone said there, the Inflation Reduction Act is one of the, what they think is one of the catalytic factors here. And as they said, it doesn't...
Inflation Increase Act.
It doesn't do what it says on the tin. It's doing the opposite. So there's a hell of a lot of fiscal stimulus.
Because it's stimulating manufacturing.
Huge,
just pouring money into
there's
the
a huge amount of money going into the US economy, and there's all these concerns about, you know, debt spiking up to unsustainable levels there, etc. And that is what is driving the economic growth in the US, and it is remarkable. I mean, across the world, there hasn't been this recession that was anticipated by as a result of much higher interest rates. I mean, the UK had that, you know, it's had that tiny little technical recession, but we're already out of it, it seems.
I mean, what I loved was 2023, because we were expecting a flatlining economy, then it was in a recession, then it was growing. I mean, it's true that everything was all over the place, but part of it is also reshoring, right? So the US economy is bringing back so much of their manufacturing that kind of boosted. Everything seems to have been happening at the same time. So after COVID, people are spending. There's a lot of immigration that's helping with productivity. So it's almost like the perfect storm to the upside for the US economy.
Yeah. So the Made in America policies of Biden, massive fiscal spending. Those two things, and have seen that there has definitely been a massive increase in spending power. Living standards are improving. GDP is growing really fast. And the IMF estimates that the US economy is now 0.7 percentage points above what is sort of its actual speed limit, which effectively they'd be saying, you know, all else, you know, equal, there should be rate rises. And obviously they've just started to hold rates after a massive increase in rates. So
a few weeks back, I saw commentary that maybe in the States, the Fed would be inclined to do a cut as a helping hand to Biden. That now sounds like that might be for the birds.
At the current juncture, that definitely looks extraordinarily unlikely. And obviously, Jay Powell, the head of the Fed, has pulled back. I mean, he's definitely signaling that they're not going to be cutting anytime soon. Seems extraordinarily unlikely that they are actually going to raise rates, as the IMF forecast would suggest. But they don't look like they're going to do any interest rate cuts.
I mean, obviously, it's all so important, isn't it, what the central bankers say, and everyone, particularly for the Fed, everyone pours over the exact phrasing, the sentences, every comma or full stop means something. But there is a theory, is there not, that by him saying that they were going to be, or signaling rate cuts earlier this year, has actually added to inflation because people have baked in already that that was coming. So is it Powell's fault that the messaging, I mean, I know it's a, you know, it's an impossible art, isn't it, being a central banker, but did they get the messaging wrong? Is that why everyone mispriced where inflation was headed?
Well, inflation was falling quite quickly. Last week, actually, Jeremy Hunt when he was out in the US, he actually suggested that, you know, you can declare victory. UK can declare victory over inflation. And that's effectively what had happened in America. They effectively declared victory over inflation. And then inflation...
Foolhardy thing.
But then the very next day, right? Very next day, the drop wasn't as much as was expected.
It was not, exactly. And so what you're seeing is the inflation persistence, that underlying, you know, the wages rising, services inflation is proving sticky. And so they haven't been able to squeeze inflation out as easily as they thought in the US. And the fear would be for, you know, the read across to the UK would be that maybe we still have very high underlying measures of inflation. And the fear is that, you know, we are also going to find it more difficult to squeeze out these last vestiges of inflation.
But the difference, I guess, here, rather depressingly, is that we don't have, going along with that inflation, roaring GDP growth, boosting, you know, large increases in domestic manufacturing. So the Britain finds itself, as you said earlier, has just emerged from a very mild technical recession, but a recession nonetheless. So we're nowhere near where the US is in terms of growth.
Yeah, well, exactly. That was the IMF analysis in their World Economic Outlook. It basically, both the Eurozone and the UK are operating below what the capacity of the economy is, which means that we in theory do need to cut rates to just boost that sort of demand level to get the economy going at it, you know, growing at its speed limit, as economists like to term it. So we are in a very different place to the US the economy is looking like it is picking up at the moment. So that's definitely positive, but it's not going gangbusters at all. Like, I mean, obviously, we're growing at 0.5% this year, according to the IMF, which is pretty miserable, really.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here as in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.
Just to sort of remove ourselves from America and step back to where we are right now, which is the UK. Tell us about Andrew Bailey. I'm kind of fascinated by him and by his Monetary Policy Committee now. Firstly, they as an institution seem kind of gloriously freewheeling in that they say very different things on very different days. Is that your impression? Is that, to me, it seems quite healthy.
Yeah, I think this, it is part of the way that the bank operates, which is particularly, they've got four external members. So they've got five on the Monetary Policy Committee, five internals. So five will represent exactly what the Bank of England thinks. So they would, you'd expect them to move more as a sort of homogenous mass. And then the five externals are there effectively to challenge, you know, consensus opinion. And, you know, so the idea is to break groupthink. And if you think back to the Carney days where, you know, groupthink was an issue, became an issue in the political sphere for why does the bank all of the members of the MPC all seem to vote the same way? We should be having checks and balances on monetary policy decision making. So the fact that Megan Green and Catherine Mann in particular have been, you know, distinctly more hawkish than recent comments from the Governor Andrew Bailey or his deputy Dave Ramsden, you know, just does show that the committee is working. As you say, it is healthy to have.
Because you wouldn't get that
tests.
At the top of a political party. Maybe you would. It's refreshing because it is a genuine dialogue, and I think probably both views are valid, right? So it's not that one is more valid than the other, but it's just difficult to, you know, one day we think, oh right, Bailey's gearing up to cut quite soon, and obviously that has an effect on the markets. And then the sort of, you know, a day and a half later, you get somebody from his team saying something different.
You'll have different governors depending on their characteristics, on their personalities, and Andrew Bailey is definitely the kind of person who is quite happy to tolerate dissent and doesn't see it as something that undermines him. Although, you know, externally it can look like he's undermined. You know, that he may want to vote in one direction, and others on the committee may vote against him. And he could, we haven't seen it with Andrew Bailey, but he could potentially be outvoted. And as the governor, that might look like he's a weak governor. Mervyn King was outvoted a few times when he was governor, but that doesn't actually undermine the governor's authority or the institution.
But to Allegra's very good point, they did have to get Ben Bernanke to do a review on communications at the Bank of England. So you have people like Mohamed Elrian saying actually it's refreshing, and you know you have all views, and so you can assess. But then they had to get an external former Fed president to look at how it was working because markets were complaining that they weren't getting the right information.
Yeah, that the market reaction to how the bank communicates is a tricky one because there isn't, as you say, because there isn't a single voice. Bernanke's review doesn't resolve that because basically these are supposed to be people with their own individual opinions on things. But it does help what he's proposing does help communicate, you know, what they see the economic outlook to be. He wants to improve the communication of their forecasts, of their ability, you know, of the way that they see policy will evolve, as which is a bit more like the American system where there's the dot plot, so you can see it's not going to be the dot plots, but you can see something which would indicate the way policy should move. And at the moment, they don't really provide that. In fact, they don't provide that at all, which is a much more confusing way of communicating. So
my favorite moment of the press conference is sometimes where someone says, but the market was expecting this. And usually, I mean, it's happened twice where Governor Bailey says, well, Bloomberg Economics got it right.
There we go.
Speaking of Bloomberg Economics, is predicting that the bank starts to cut in the summer, and lots of other people, lots of banks are predicting that too, but traders are not. So help us unpick that.
This is another tricky one. And actually, this has seemed to be one of the main issues that Andrew Bailey was trying to address out at Washington at the IMF. But so the market path, in the UK for rate cuts has a first rate cut happening in, I think it's even moving as we're speaking, but in around September. It had pushed the first rate cut out to, the market had pushed the first rate cut out to November at one point. Part of this is because our market is affected by what happens in the US. And because the Federal Reserve is such a powerful global institution, it changes the outlook in the way the markets price everything. And so the outlook for the UK then looks different. And that effectively creates a communication problem for the Bank of England, because they have their own vision of what the market path should be. And at one point this year, they thought the indication seemed to be that first rate rise could be in June. If it's not going to happen until November, according to the markets, that seems extraordinarily unlikely under current forecasts. So the Bank of England officials are trying to talk the market round into sort of stripping out this sort of Fed premium that's sort of priced into the UK market to try and get it back on track. And
hands up in the air.
I find it impossible. I mean, it's like the Fed's gravitational pull and what it does to dollar. Every time a central banker says, well, we focus on our own economy, it's like, well, yeah, sure, buddy, but everything around you is changing.
So if the Fed doesn't cut interest rates until the end of the year or maybe next year, and we wait in the UK, we're just going to punish our economy. But the difficulty for the bank is that then we would have more inflation, because 20% of the basket of currencies that we're measured against is the dollar. And so, you know, they have to think about the second round effects. And this was the discussion in terms of BOE policy at the IMF was, you know, if the US isn't going to cut till much later and the UK will, if there is a sterling reaction, you've got to factor that into your thinking of how many cuts you're going to be doing, because you're going to get some inflation back into the system just by cutting interest rates. So it is confusing, but it requires clear communications, which obviously, you know, haven't been perfect in the past.
and a crystal ball.
But they're definitely moving towards the ability to move at different times. So the first cut can come in the UK and in the European, at the European Central Bank before the Fed without these, you know, severe repercussions.
Do we really need to be? I mean, it feels a little bit from everything you've been saying, Phil, that, you know, the market is a few steps behind here. And why do we need to cut rates in the UK? You know, the FTSE 100 hit a record. Yesterday, we're taping this on Tuesday, right? We had a record in the UK stock market. We've seen reports that house prices have stabilized. In fact, asking prices are going up a little bit. We're out of that technical recession. That doesn't really add up to me as a moment when you start cutting interest rates, does it? And especially if inflation, as Allegra said, is proving stickier than it was supposed to be.
You speak, Dave, like a man who's not thinking about politics.
The bank shouldn't be either, Allegra. Obviously, they're very, if you ask them, they're absolutely adamant that politics doesn't come into their thinking at all. Of course not. Part of the reason that the economy is doing better, as you were saying earlier, Dave, is because interest rates, the market path for interest rates had fallen quite sharply. So that effectively had brought in lower borrowing costs for mortgages and commercial and small businesses as well. They would be facing lower borrowing costs. The reason why rates have to be cut is the bank's own internal analysis is that, you know, the stable rate, the interest rate that we need in the UK is significantly below 5.25%. So you can cut to say 4.5 or wherever it ends up being without actually, if you've got your foot on the brake at the moment, you're just easing the foot off the brake rather than putting it on the accelerator. So that just can help growth in general. But also, you know, small businesses are paying off debt rather than investing. You know, companies are worrying about future debt sustainability issues. Households are still having to reset onto higher rates. And
And that's a really extended process, isn't it?
And it's very slow. It's because of the fixed rate phenomenon here. But there is pain that is still coming through the economy. So it's the idea, the dream, certainly from the political point of view, is that you get this soft landing where, you know, inflation comes down to its 2% and you just get the economy just going, taking off at the same time as inflation comes down. And and then the election's held in October or whenever it is.
I read in maybe one of your brilliant pieces, there was an analyst quoted as saying, we shouldn't really have a rate cut this year, or maybe it would be November or December, but maybe there will be one, I'm quoting here, as a political favour to a government that at some point is going to want to have an election. How does that work? What is that actual relationship as far as you can tell?
Yeah.
No, I am quoting someone.
Yeah. It's
was it in your piece?
There was.
It's definitely in the readout.
Some people do think that the bank has to get ahead of the game here, because if it's necessary to cut rates economically and you're already in the process of an election, so there's the campaign has started, etc., you cut rates at that point, say 3 weeks after the election is called, I mean, it is going to become a massively political issue, and there'll be cries of foul play about the bank doing it if they...
To be clear, you think that is it a rule, or is it an expectation that they wouldn't do anything during an election campaign?
I don't think they would. I think they wouldn't do anything during an election. So I went back through the data, and they did do it during an election campaign once. I think it was 2001, but it was like 2 days after the election was called. So they were obviously already planning it, but they wouldn't... I don't think they would want to start cutting in an election. If they were already, you know, had done a rate cut or possibly two rate cuts, and then you go into the election and then you have to keep cutting rates because the economy is saying that, it makes it clear that you really need to, I think they could continue doing it at that point. But they need to get ahead of the game here, otherwise they can inadvertently be dragged into politics. And the thing I think the bank desperately wants to do is to avoid being dragged into politics.
Phil Aldrich, thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this week's In the City from Bloomberg.
This episode was hosted by me, Francine Lacroix, with David Merritt.
It was produced by Summer Sardi, with additional editing by Blake Maples.
Brendan Newman is our executive producer. Sage Bauman is head of podcasts. Special thanks to Phil Aldrich.
Please do subscribe, rate and review wherever you listen to podcasts.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.